Welcome to this Forthright Radio for November 15th, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the full hour is Dean Baker, co-founder, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We'll be discussing U.S. and global economics, what we know and don't know about the Republican congressional tax plans, and how that will affect us. Loser liberalism, the conservative nanny state, and much, much more. Dean Baker co-founded the Center for Economic and Policy Research in 1999. His areas of research include housing and macroeconomics, intellectual property, Social Security, Medicare, and European labor markets. Before that, he worked as a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute and was an assistant professor at Bucknell University. He has also worked as a consultant for the World Bank, the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and the OECD's Trade Union Advisory Council. He is frequently cited in economics reporting in major media outlets, including the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, CNBC, and NPR. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited, The Huffington Post, Truthout, and his blog, Beat the Press, features commentary on economic reporting. He is the author of numerous books, including Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer, Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. Well, without further ado, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Oh, it's really a delight to have you on. Dean, way back in July of 2017, you wrote an article which was published in The Guardian, How About a Little Accountability for Economists When They Mess Up? You noted that if firefighters performed the way economists do, they would lose their job. You cited the failure to foresee, much less prevent, the crash of 2008, which you did foresee. Would you please expand on your perspective of the current state of the profession?
Yeah, I mean, the point I was making there is that we had a horrible disaster hit us and really the whole world economy. And the view of most economists, I think, as well, we made a mistake, bad things happen. And it's treated kind of like a hurricane hitting. I mean, you don't hold the weather person responsible for a hurricane. And my point was that, no, it wasn't a hurricane. It wasn't a natural event. This was entirely foreseeable, entirely predictable. You didn't need a crystal ball. In a lot of ways, these things were really right in front of us. And I was talking about this. I wrote extensively on it. I was making as much noise as I could. Basically, you had a huge housing bubble, and it was easy to see it was a housing bubble because it was nothing like anything we had seen in the past. We had this huge run-up in house prices, didn't correspond to a run-up in rents. There was no obvious reason why people would suddenly view housing as being more valuable. It was not a period of strong economic growth where people were just flush with money and saying, oh, sure, I'll get a bigger home because I just got a big pay raise. I don't know what to do with it. None of that was going on. And there were no obvious shortages of land. We didn't suddenly have this huge influx of population. I mean, you go down the list. There was no plausible story that explained this run-up in house prices, which led me to believe it was a bubble. And the idea we have bubbles shouldn't have been that strange to people because we had just had a really big bubble in the stock market that burst in 2001, 2002. So not seeing that was incredible negligence on the part of my colleagues in the economics profession, and not realizing that that would have enormous consequences. This was driving the economy, and again, this is very clear in the data that economists look at all the time. So we get the GDP numbers, gross domestic product numbers, every quarter. So if you look at those, you know, going back to 2005, 2006, housing was at a record share of GDP, housing construction, and that obviously was being driven by record high house prices. People try to build a lot of houses when housing's expensive. Surprise, surprise, that's pretty basic. Also, consumption was at a very high level. Again, a record share of GDP. Obvious reason is that people bought a home for $200,000, it's now worth $400,000. Well, they spend some of that. Again, this is pretty basic economics. We have something, a well-known called housing wealth effect, that people spend based on their wealth. So if you see your house price doubles, well, you're likely to spend some of that. So people would borrow against it sometimes, or maybe they just didn't put money into a 401k because they go, well, I have $100,000 more in my home than I was expecting, so why do I have to put money in a 401k? I'm doing good. So there was big surge in consumption. So point was that when house prices corrected, as it was reasonable to believe they would, you see on the one hand a huge fall off in construction, which of course we did, and at the same time a huge fall off in consumption because the wealth, people had the 400,000 homes, suddenly see it go back to 200,000. So that's what gave us this really horrible recession, and of course we got the credit collapse, which again, 100% predictable. The fact that banks were issuing bad loans was not a secret. You didn't need to do sleuth work. It was being widely talked about. There were jokes about ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets. People knew that mortgages were being issued on very questionable grounds because they could sell them anywhere in the world. They didn't care if people could pay them back. So all of this was 100% foreseeable, and the people who have as a job to foresee things like that didn't, and then they all hold their jobs. And I got a lot of people really angry. They usually think I'm joking when I say, oh, well, people should have lost their jobs. Yeah, it's funny. I go, no. They should have lost their jobs. And then they think I'm being vindictive. You know, I don't know most of these people. I don't have any personal feelings about them. It's just they didn't do their jobs. And as an economist, you know, there's a whole literature saying that it's really important to be able to fire people if they aren't doing their jobs effectively. And yet, somehow, when you talk to economists and say, well, maybe this should apply to us, then they're just appalled. Like, how can you hold us responsible? So I think the profession's in a horrible state. A lot of people should have lost their jobs. In almost no cases did they. And for the most part, when you look at who are the senior, the top people in the profession, they were the same people who somehow failed to see this huge housing bubble that sank the U.S. economy, and again, really the whole world economy. That's pretty damning of the profession.
A few months ago, we interviewed Duke University history professor Nancy McLean about her book, Democracy in Chains. In that, she asserts that Nobel Prize winner James M. Buchanan based his theories entirely on thought experiments, eschewing data. You were talking about data-driven stuff. And economics purports to be a science, but how can it reward non-data-driven theories, especially the kind that are used to govern, such as Buchanan and Milton Friedman's were in Pinochet's Chile, to disastrous effect, I might add?
Yeah, it is kind of incredible. I mean, I don't know if this was so much of a theory, because there wasn't anything in the economic theories, at least I'm familiar with, that prevented them from seeing this. I think it was more kind of the hierarchy within the profession, that as long as Martin Feldstein at Harvard and Larry Summers at Harvard, as long as they say everything's okay, then everything's okay and I don't have to pay attention. There's a meeting every year that the central banks, it's held at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and it's sponsored by the Federal Reserve Board, actually Kansas City Federal Reserve Board. But in any case, it brings together people from prominent economists from around the world. And at that meeting, and I'm trying to get my year straight, I believe it was 2005, they had a Greenspan retrospective. I actually knew one of the governors at the time. He was a professor of mine when I was in grad school, and I stayed in touch with him casually. And I bumped into him, and I said, oh, you're going to the meeting? I said, he goes, yeah. And he goes, so I said, what's it about? And he said, it's a Greenspan retrospective. And I laughed, and then I realized, oh, he's serious. But in any case, it was all about praising Alan Greenspan, because at that time they just thought Alan Greenspan was absolutely the greatest. And there was one economist, Rajaram Rajan, who was at the time a professor at the University of Chicago. He went on to be the head of the central bank in India. But in any case, he raised issues saying that, you know, oh, you know, I'm concerned that we have a lot of instability in the system and people haven't looked at risk carefully, et cetera, making a lot of very good points. Anyhow, Larry Summers, who was the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton and then head of the National Economic Council under President Obama, in the meantime he was president of Harvard, so a very, very prominent economist, he was in the audience and he just derided him. He said he called him a Luddite, that you just don't understand modern finance. And of course, Rajaram Rajan understood modern finance very well, but you know, the point here is, here's Larry Summers, very prominent economist, a good economist. He knows a lot of stuff. I've gotten a lot out of his work over the years. But in any case, he was just totally dismissive. And that was the general pattern of that conference. So here it is. You had all these top economists in the world, and they're just like, they don't want to acknowledge that you actually can have a problem here. It required some out-of-the-box thinking, and, you know, here's Rajan. I mean, he himself was a prominent economist. I think he was comfortable standing up to Larry Summers, but the point was a lot of people aren't. So, you know, I see it more as a question of hierarchy within the discipline, and as it was, the top names in the profession were just saying, everything's great, everything's great. Alan Greenspan's a genius. How can you quarrel with what he's done? And to raise questions about would have exposed you to ridicule, as, you know, again, Rajan won. Rajan, again, I'm sure he's confident enough he could stand up to it, but most economists don't have quite his background, his standing.
Well, you mentioned that the housing fall was a bubble. I'm wondering if we're experiencing a bubble now with record stock market levels. This morning, apparently the stock market is down, but I'm old enough to remember when hitting 10,000 was this enormous achievement. It was like running under a 4-minute mile or something. And now we're up 23,000, I should say. Do you see this as another bubble?
I think stock prices are high. I once said they're a bubble, and I'll contrast this because I was warning about a bubble back in the late 90s. Stock prices are high. They're not as high relative to corporate earnings as they were back in the late 90s or peak of 2000. So they aren't that high, but they are high. But on the other hand, you don't have clear alternatives. So the basic story here is that interest rates are very, very low. So back in the late 90s, I was saying to people, I go, look, you know, I could get a U.S. government bond that pays me 6% interest, a 30-year bond that pays me 6% interest. That's about as safe as you could have because U.S. government's not going out of business. And what's more, if it does, your stock's not going to be worth anything anyhow. So here you have, for all practical purposes, perfectly safe investments going to give you 6% interest. At that time, the inflation rate was around 2%, so 4 percentage points above the inflation rate. The other hand, I could put money in the stock market, and you're very hard-pressed to come up with a story where you'd get anything in excess of that return, and you could easily see it fall, which, of course, it did, in which case you'd get a lot less. So I was just asking, why would people put money, in many cases all of their money, in the stock market? It didn't make any sense. Today, if you look at a 30-year Treasury bond, and I have to say I haven't looked at it the last week or 2 weeks, but I don't think it's over 3%. If it is, it's a hair over. The inflation rate today, it's a little lower. It's, I think, 1.8% was the number that just came out today. So here you're looking at a return that's maybe 1.5 percentage points above the inflation rate. So you don't have a good, obvious alternative. So it wouldn't, saying this, it wouldn't shock me, it wouldn't surprise me at all, really, if the stock market were to fall by 10%, even 15%. It does that, and it's high, and that's a totally plausible story. But in the late 90s, as I said, I felt very comfortable saying it was a bubble because these were inconsistent. Given the high, it wasn't that high necessarily, but much higher than today, given what you can get on a government bond, a perfectly safe asset, given the returns you could expect in the stock market, given those prices, how high the prices were, you'd have been crazy to hold stock. So I felt, as I say, I was warning people it looked like a bubble. I wouldn't say that today. I would certainly tell someone, if you have money in the stock market, don't expect a real high return because you can't get it, no way on earth, which what it does tomorrow, I have no idea. But, I mean, over, say, a 5 or 10-year period, you aren't going to get a high return with money in the stock market. But I don't know, somewhere else I could tell you where you'll necessarily do better. So I don't think it's a bubble, but, again, there is a chance that it will go down. I'll also point out, unlike the late 90s, it's not driving the economy. So in the late 90s, you actually did have a story where it was kind of following the textbook. This almost never happens. But in the late 90s, you actually did have companies that were directly financing investment by issuing stock. So you had all these startups, these Internet companies that, in many cases, literally had no clue what they were doing. They didn't even know how they could make a profit. And they could raise hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars with IPO, initial public offering. And then they would use that to invest in their plans. So that actually was driving investment. And also you had a consumption boom based on the fact that all these people suddenly had made all their money in the stock market. So again, same sort of thing I was saying a moment ago about housing. You could say that about stock in the late 90s. And then when prices plummeted, 2001, 2002, they fell by 50% over that period. Suddenly, of course, the investment boom came to an end. and consumption fell back because people who thought they had 200,000 in the market found out they only had 100,000 in the market. So we don't, I think, face that same sort of risk. The stock market's not driving the economy today. I don't think there's the risk of it falling 50%. It certainly could fall 10 or 15. But I'm not worried about it in the way I was in the late 90s.
Now, you did mention as something of an aside, if the government bonds and if the U.S. government defaults on the bonds, don't worry because your stocks won't be valuable either. That brings up the changing situation in terms of who the world economic powers are. And I'm reading things increasingly, which I find worrisome as a citizen of the United States, that this country is in decline as a world economic power in comparison to China. I wonder what your perspective is on that.
Let's put it this way. We are, the economy is still growing. We have a basically healthy economy. There's lots of issues I can and do raise about it, but it's a growing economy. And actually, in the last two or three years, most people have actually been benefiting. They've been sharing that growth. But relative to China, yeah, they're hugely outgrowing us. I mean, their growth rate's around 7%. By the most common measure that economists use to make comparisons, international comparisons, China's already like 20% larger than the U.S. economy. It's looking at their GDP on a purchasing power parity basis. What that would mean is, in principle, it's never done perfectly, but we use the same set of prices for everything in the U.S. and China. So table costs the same in both places, a car costs the same, a haircut, on down the list, everything you could think of that people would buy costs the same in both places. So when you do that measure, it's about 20% larger than the U.S. economy already, and it's growing 7% a year. We're growing 2% if we're really lucky, 3%. So, yeah, they're bigger than us, and they're going to be much bigger, say, 10 years out. So that's kind of the way things are going to be. They have 1.3 billion people. We have 320 million. It just stands to reason over time they're going to be much larger, and that's an issue. I mean, so if we think it's important for the U.S. to be dominant actor in the world, that's going to become less likely when you have an economy that's 40-50% and probably before too long 100% larger than our economy.
There are those who say that it's only a very short time before the U.S. dollar is no longer the standard currency in which trade is done in the world, and that it will be replaced by the Chinese currency. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but it's like Renminbi or something
Renminbi,
like that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that'll happen over time. I think people have made too much of a deal out of this. The dollar is one of the world's reserve currencies. It's the predominant one, just to be clear. But it's one of them. It's not the only reserve currency. So if you look at what central banks hold as an asset, probably 50 to 60%, I haven't looked at the data recently, is dollars. But a substantial chunk is now euros, probably 20 or 30%. They even hold a lot of British pounds, and many of them even have Swiss francs. So what I envision is, let's go out 10, 15, 20 years. I'd be very surprised if they don't hold a very substantial amount of Chinese renminbi or yuan. I'm not sure the distinction. Those are both terms for their currency, so I don't know when exactly use one rather than the other. But in any case, I'm sure they'll have a substantial amount of Chinese currency. They'll still have a substantial amount of dollars. They'll probably still have, I'm sure they'll have euros and probably still have some British pounds. So the idea that that's something we should really fear, I think that's just wrong-headed. There's consequences to it. I'm not going to say it has zero consequences, but it really isn't a disastrous story. I mean, it's a disastrous story if we reach a situation where people start looking at U.S. dollars and go, why would I want those? Like Zimbabwe's currency, when they had their period of hyperinflation, it was just, what would you do with it? If we have a healthy economy, we don't have to worry about that happening. And just, again, taking the case of the U.K., which is, been dwarfed by the U.S. for many years. Our economy is probably five times the size of the U.K. economy, but British pound is still a valuable world currency. So I don't see that as being a catastrophic story. Again, some consequences, but it's not a big deal. And again, I don't see any way it won't happen, because once China gets to be, as I say, in 10 years, it would probably be close to twice the size of the U.S. economy. It's very hard to imagine that their currency won't take on increasing importance.
Well, one more thing about the comparison with China, and then we'll move on. We recently interviewed Alfred McCoy, University of Wisconsin professor, and he is very focused on the rise of China. And he points out the tremendous investments in infrastructure that and modern infrastructure that they are doing now, which reminded me of the 1950s in the United States with the rise of the interstate highway system and all the boons that that brought. I'm wondering, first of all, are you aware of this? And if so, in comparison with our crumbling infrastructure in the United States now, what do you think of all that?
Well, I'm not familiar with his specific writing, but certainly the fact that China's really moved ahead with very ambitious infrastructure projects, it's quite impressive. They have more high-speed rail than the rest of the world combined, I mean, which is kind of incredible. So here's what's still a developing country. It won't be much longer because it has grown so much. Can't be a developing country when it gets a certain level of income. But in any case, it's still in the developing country category to have more high-speed rail than the rest of the world combined. They've built a huge amount of housing. There's reports I've had right-wingers tell me about these ghost cities. They don't know what they're doing. Well, not entirely. I mean, they're building ahead of demand, which in a lot of ways makes sense. And my guess is most of those, I don't know if all of them, surprised if they don't make some mistakes, but my guess is most of those ghost cities will be pretty well occupied come, I don't know their timeline, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years out. So they've done a very good job. I mean, I'm not going to praise them to the sky on this because there are downsides. I mean, they don't have the same rights we do in the sense that if the government wants to build the high-speed rail and it goes through your house, basically there they say, okay, we're building the high-speed rail and it's going to go through your house, so you're going to move. You know, they'll pay you something for it. Maybe you're not happy with it, but them's the breaks. You don't have the same rights there that you do here. That's something that's a big issue. That's a loss. I wouldn't minimize that. Many times there are bad environmental implications. The government has gotten better about that. They have begun cleaning up their environment and made very impressive steps that way. But for the longest time, they would just put these things through and didn't give a second thought to the environmental implications. So there are certainly downsides. But in terms of being able to have modern infrastructure and, you know, use that as a base for further growth, they've been way out front on that, and it's hard not to be impressed with it.
The big news is the tax plans, the proposed tax plans, and it's very much in flux now. But could you give us some idea of the differences between the House plan and the Senate plan, and what your perspective on the entire approach is?
Well, I wish I could tell you everything about the differences between plan. I'm trying to, as these come along, trying to digest them and get the main points. What's common is their big cut in the corporate income tax. So they reduce the current tax rate 35% to 20%. And just so everyone's very clear on this, because I think there's a lot of confusion, almost no company actually pays 35% in taxes. The tax code is just shot through with loopholes. So the effective tax rate, if you say, okay, what percent of their profits are they actually paying in tax, it's somewhere around 18 or 19%. So no one is, say, almost no one, I'm sure someone's going to tell me, oh, their company, this or that, but almost no one's actually paying 35%. But in any case, they're lowering the nominal rate. If you look on the books, what's the rate from 35% to 20%? That's a very large tax cut to corporate America. And that overwhelmingly goes to the richest people in the country. It goes to shareholders, basically. So there's a lot of research on this. And again, they dispute this, but I'm inclined to go with the vast majority of the research that shows around 70 or 80% of that will end up in the pockets of shareholders. So that's common to both. The other big item in there that's common to both is a lowering on the maximum tax rate on income from pass-through corporations. There's a lot of confusion on this because they talk about this as a cut on taxes for small businesses. It's nothing to do with small businesses. First off, most small businesses, this is pass-through income. So these are businesses that, by definition, are not paying any tax. They pass through the income to the individual. So it's nothing to do with the business. It has to do with the individual that gets the income. And most, if you think of someone who owns a corner store or restaurant, whatever it might be, odds are they're already in a 25% tax bracket or lower, so they get zero from this. So you're talking about a relatively small number of people that are in higher income brackets that get money from businesses that are pass-through businesses, and they would cap that at 25%. So currently, the top tax bracket is 39.6%, And if you get money from pass-through business, you pay 39.6% tax on it. They're saying, no, you'll only have to pay 25%. It's a very big tax cut to many of the richest people in the country. So that's common to both of these measures. Also, the Senate bill, another corporate tax break, they go to this principle of territoriality, which says that if you have profits in Ireland or Switzerland or the Cayman Islands, you don't have to pay taxes on it. You only have to pay taxes on your profits in the United States. This has already been a big issue because companies keep their money overseas. The way the law is written, it's if you have your profits in Ireland or wherever it might be, you don't have to pay taxes on it until you bring it back in the United States. So they have it sit there. A lot of this is just accounting. But in any case, they could defer their tax for a very long time. But this will just say they don't have to pay tax at all. And as many of us have tried to point out, if you do that, you give companies a really big incentive to make it look like their profits are in Ireland or whatever else rather than the United States, since you now pay zero tax on that. But that's common to both. Some of the aspects that differ, one of, to my mind, just incredibly cruel changes in the tax code was the House bill got rid of the deduction for medical expenses, which, just to be clear what this is, as it stands now, if I have high medical bills, if I or my wife have really high medical bills, I could deduct the bills in excess of 10% of my income. So this isn't you go to the doctor for a few checkups and, you know, have some minor issues dealt with or whatever. That won't get you the deduction. This is people with serious illnesses. These are people with heart disease or going in for major surgery or cancer. So people have really big bills. They could deduct that from their income and therefore have lower taxes. That's not, to my mind, exactly a big giveaway. And, of course, most of the people in the situation, they actually don't have the money. If you have someone who's dealing with a family member with cancer, they have bills of $40,000 or $50,000. Well, that's not income for them. So they're not going to be able to pay tax on it. And as we know, many people already go bankrupt because of medical bills, and this would just increase that. So that was in the House bill. They were going to change that. The Senate bill, again, at least the latest version, leaves that deduction in. They were also going to cap the House bill, cap the mortgage interest deduction. Actually, not a bad thing to do. Could have a deduction of $500,000 in the interest on the principal. That's out of the Senate bill. One thing that's in both bills is they take away the deduction for state and local taxes. And this is just incredibly cynical because what the Republicans, obviously they know this, that the states that tend to have high income taxes are mostly Democratic states. So think California, think New York. These are states that are obviously overwhelmingly Democratic. They voted disproportionately for Clinton rather than Trump in the last election. And they're going to be hit with a big tax increase because they're no longer going to be able to deduct state and local taxes from their income on their tax bills. So those are some of the highlights. Again, there's a lot more in there. You get to a lot of sort of nitpicky things because they're trying to make it add up. Well, I should qualify, make it add up. They've set themselves the target of not increasing the debt by more than $1.5 trillion over the next decade. So to hit that, because they have some things, these are big tax cuts for corporations and for high-end earners or the people with pass-through corporation income, to try to get that, they have to throw in a lot of tax increases on various people, and a lot of middle-income people will end up paying more with this.
Let's go back to this territoriality, especially in light of revelations of the Paradise Papers. Katharina van den Heuvel wrote an article called Republican Tax Bills Would Be Paradise for Plutocrats, referring to the Paradise Papers. First of all, share with our listeners, what are the Paradise Papers? What have they shown? And how does this territoriality in any way differ from what's already happening?
Well, the Paradise Papers were showing that you have a lot of rich people that have money squirreled away with various tax havens and basically avoiding massive amounts of tax liability. So you have also people of, I was going to say, billions, trillions of dollars, and obviously it's rich people. You don't have bus drivers and waitresses that are doing this. These are the richest people in the country that have squirreled money away in tax havens that allow them to avoid paying taxes. Territoriality means is that you're only taxing a company on the profits it makes in your country, which has two effects. One, people emphasize this, and I think they're largely wrong to do it. I think there's very few cases where companies literally move their operations to avoid taxes. So this is a story that Apple sets up in Ireland to avoid paying taxes. I don't think that's true to any great extent. I'm not going to say zero, but I don't think that's true to any great extent. What I think is true to a very large extent is they have their profits show up in Ireland. And the story I would tell with Apple, what do they make? They make the iPhone. Well, they don't literally make the iPhone. They contract that out. I think Foxconn makes the iPhone, a Taiwanese company that operates in China. They're the ones that actually manufacture the iPhone. Where does Apple get its money? Apple gets its money because they have all these patents and copyrights. Well, where do those patents and copyrights come from? Well, Apple could tell us where they come from because we have no damn idea. So Apple's doing research all the time. They end up getting a patent that they think is going to be really valuable. Well, they could say it was done by the research team in Silicon Valley and say, oh, yeah, that's where all our money was made because it came from this patent. Or they could say, what do you know, it was in Ireland, a very low-tax country. That was where the research team came up with the big innovation, and that's where the patent came from. We have no way of knowing. So with territoriality, where you just say, oh, we're only going to tax you on the profits you earned in the United States, we've just told Apple, oh, why don't you just play games with us and just tell us all your profits were in Ireland, and you don't have to pay us any tax. Now, they already do that, as I said. They already do that to a substantial extent because we have this deferral. So they could say, oh, it was earned in Ireland, and we'd say, okay, well, let us know when you bring it back, and then we'll tax it. So they already do that, but this is just a green light. Just go ahead and do it even more, because if you tell us it was in Ireland, well, then I guess it was in Ireland, and you don't have to owe us any money. So that they will game that. I mean, it's just a safe bet that why on earth wouldn't a company game it? I mean, it's kind of, you know, just flip it over. Why would they not? They have the ability to do it. Why would they not do it? Now, one of the things that I put on the table, and I've raised this with economists, it's actually not technical at all. If we want to make sure we get our share of companies' profits, we could just tell them to issue us non-voting shares of stock. I'm saying non-voting because I'm not trying to take over the companies. I'm just saying we want to claim to their profits, which is what taxes are about. So we pick a number. Let's say we think 25% is the target we're shooting for. And we tell Apple, okay, give us shares, non-voting shares, equal to 25% of your outstanding shares. These shares get everything your other shares get. If you pay them a $2 dividend, you pay us a $2 dividend. You buy back 10% of your shares at $100, you buy back 10% of our shares at $100. Someone takes you over $150 a share, they buy up our shares at $150. That would be pretty hard for them to avoid. And the nice thing about it is they have no reason to play games. If it makes sense for them to locate in Ireland, if they're good people there and they think that's a smart thing to do, they could do that. But they won't be doing that to avoid their taxes because it doesn't save them a penny in taxes. They still owe us the same money.
That's an interesting idea. Are you getting any responses to that?
Well, among economists, a lot really like that because I've been throwing this around. I've been going, tell me what's wrong with this. And obviously, you talk about doing anything in the world, there's always going to be a complication. So I'm sure, you know, if I get a chance and Donald Trump goes, yeah, that's a good idea, let's do it, you know, he's not going to do that. But, you know, I'm sure when you try to implement it, there would be issues. I mean, there's no way on earth that you could talk about overhauling the tax code and there not be some issues. But no one has come up with anything that is really an obvious obstacle. So that's one of the reasons why I keep talking about it, because I go, well, if this is stupid, by now, someone should have been able to tell me why it's stupid. Say, I'm willing to believe. I come up with lots of ideas, and some of them I like to think are good, and I know many of them are stupid. So if this one's a stupid one, no one, including some very smart people, have heard it. They've been able to tell me why.
Okay, so that's an example of a company that actually produces a product, Apple. Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, wrote an article last summer, Donald Trump's Tax Cuts for the Rich Won't Make American Great Again, in which he talks about Trump's dilemma, and I'm going to quote it briefly. His tax reform must be revenue neutral. That's a political imperative. With corporations sitting on trillions of dollars in cash, while ordinary Americans are suffering, lowering the average amount of corporate taxation would be unconscionable, and more so if taxes were lowered for the financial sector, which brought on the 2008 crisis and never paid for the economic damage. Moreover, Senate procedures dictate that to enact tax reform with a simple majority rather than the 3/5 supermajority required to defeat an almost certain filibuster by opposition Democrats, the reform must be budget neutral for 10 years. So let's talk about that part of the economy that has this $1 trillion of cash they're just playing financial games. They're not, many of these corporations, they're not producing anything tangible. And yet they are looking at a tax break with the rhetoric that it will somehow stimulate growth in the economy. What say you, Dean Baker?
Yeah, I'm certainly inclined to very much agree with Stiglitz here. The whole logic of this is that somehow corporations need more money, that with more money, more incentive, they would be doing all this investment. And, you know, again, he makes this point that they're sitting on trillions of dollars. They don't have uses for their money. So why would anyone think if we go, okay, here's a big tax cut, now go out and invest? And they're sitting there. They're always happy to make money. I mean, I think that's a reasonable assumption. So if they thought there were ways for them to be making money, they would already be doing it. And then we could say, oh, well, then they could do a little more if they had more money. But they're sitting on their money. They're sitting on trillions of dollars. So this idea that somehow there's going to be this burst of investment, it really just doesn't make any sense. But then on top of that, you know, his point about Wall Street. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan. I know Stiglitz also has written on this. I'm a big fan of financial transactions tax. Part of that, of course, raises money. You could raise, by my calculations, over $100 billion a year. If we're talking about over a decade, as you know, this discussion tends to be over a decade, probably in the order of $1.3, $1.4 trillion, real money. So you could do that. But the other part of that story is you would eliminate a huge amount of the waste in the financial sector. So a lot of what we heard about in the days of the financial crisis, it's still going on today, but you had things like collateralized debt obligations, synthetic collateralized debt obligations. You go, okay, how is this helping the economy? We all understand the need for a financial sector. So I want to borrow money from my house. I have a mortgage on my house. Most people do. Okay, I need that. I need a bank. That's where I get it. If I were starting a business, odds are I'd look to borrow some of the money for the business. We all understand that. We all understand the need for the financial sector. We go, okay, so how did a collateralized debt obligation make it easier for anyone to borrow money for their home, borrow money for their business, make their savings more secure? I mean, you almost can't say that with a straight face. So if you downsize the financial sector with the modest tax, the tax that I and others have talked about on the order of, for trades of stocks, somewhere on the order of 0.2%, so that would discourage a lot of this sort of short-term speculative trading because it wouldn't be worth it. It would take the profit out. But for sort of longer-term investment, if I'm buying 100 shares of General Electric that I expect to hold for 10 years or 20 years, it'd be trivial. No one would like to pay it. I mean, I grant that no one ever wants to pay a tax. But most people, if they're investing in the stock market, they couldn't tell you what their broker charged them, how big a percentage was. I mean, they probably have a ballpark number, but if they're a tenth of a percentage point higher, odds are they won't even notice it. So to my view, that's what we want, is a downsized financial sector. What the Republican tax plan is likely to give us is a bigger financial sector. It's going the wrong way.
I would love to ask you to compare it to what happened under Ronald Reagan. There were many of the same rhetorical assertions made. Well, all right, let's go there. But don't spend a lot of time. Let's do a comparison to what was attempted under the Ronald Reagan tax cuts.
Well, Reagan and George W. Bush, I've joked about how this is like Lucy in the football with Charlie Brown, where they're telling us, we're going to have a tax cut, and this time it's going to lead to a lot of growth and there'll be big payoffs for everyone. So, okay, Reagan told us that. And then George W. Bush told us that. Neither time did we see good growth, or certainly not growth that most workers shared in. And now they're telling us again. And it's kind of like, okay, are you kidding me? You know, some of us were alive long enough to remember this, but even if you weren't, you could read about it. There was not this boom following either of those tax cuts, particularly the second, the Bush tax cuts. We had, of course, very weak labor market, very little wage growth, and then, of course, the economic collapse in 2008. I mean, I don't blame that as tax cuts, but it's pretty hard to tell a good story about the economy post-Bush tax cuts.
Well, while all this is going on and all the attention is focused on the tax situation and reformation, whatever you want to call it, there's changes going on with the Dodd-Frank, particularly the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Please talk about that.
Yeah, you know, we got the Dodd-Frank bill, obviously, in the wake of the crash, the collapse, and it was to rein in some of the excesses in the financial industry. And I know I myself, and I think many of the other economists who were following it, doing some work on it, we thought was good, but very limited. I mean, given the damage to the economy, this didn't exactly put Wall Street in chains. And you can contrast to what happened after the Great Depression, where we had things like Glass-Steagall was passed. The banking system was very tightly regulated following the Great Depression, with the idea that it should be regulated, that we do want to keep a careful eye on them. So in any case, this was a step up in regulation, and the idea was both, on the one hand, to protect consumers from being abused by the industry, and on the other hand, to try and protect us from some of the instability, some of the risky practices that the industry was clearly engaged in before 2008. And in both respects, the Republicans under Trump are looking to roll things back. And I'll just mention one that's come up already, and to my view, a pretty big thing. They voted to take away the power of people to have class action suits against the financial industry. So where it stands now, if you sign a contract, if you have a credit card, I mean, people might even think of it as signing a contract, but if you have a credit card, you signed a contract with whoever issued it, and there's almost certainly a clause in there saying that if you have any dispute with whoever it was, Citigroup, whoever issued the credit card, it goes to the arbitrator. And they, of course, pick the arbitrator, and they tend to be very pro-business. And it prohibits you from having a class action suit. Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was headed by an Obama appointee, said, no, that's not allowed. You can put anything you want in your contract, but you can't bind people with that. So people can have class action suits. Well, the Republicans just overturned that. And the reason why that matters is, let's say that they ripped me off for $100. I had something literally like this happened. I mean, it's not good to argue by anecdote, but I'm sure many people have had something similar. I paid a credit card bill literally one day late. I was traveling, and because they have a lot of bills on there, they charged me 1.5% interest. And then on top of that, I think it was a $50 late fee. So I think actually the fee they won was something like $150. So anyway, I had a big argument with them, and at the end of it, they end up giving in to me. In any case, a lot of people might have got stuck paying that. Kind of nuts. One day, you're going to spend $150. Anyhow, I'm sure, as I said, they're doing that to lots of people and collecting a lot of money and fees like that. Well, no one in their right mind is going to take up a lawsuit against the bank for $150. Even if you win, you're going to pay way more in legal fees than you could ever hope to gain. But what you could do is have a class action suit and go, hey, there's 20,000 of us who are in this situation. Well, they've prohibited that. So what you've done is both made it easy to rip people off, but the flip side, just thinking as an economist, you've given banks incentive to rip people off because they could put things like that in their contract and not much you could do about it. So that's, to my mind, a big deal. You're giving them an incentive to rip people off. The other part, as I said, they're weakening the rules. They've already, they haven't implemented yet, but they're rolling back the rules on stress tests that banks have to show they could withstand a downturn in the economy without facing serious credit issues. They've exempted more banks from having reviews, so you could be a bigger bank now without having reviews. And they're also looking to roll back the Volcker Rule, which prevents banks with insured deposits from engaging in speculative activity. So they're looking to roll back, as I say, I think Dodd-Frank was a relatively modest reform, but it was going in the right direction. They're looking to roll back most of what was in there.
Well, particularly with the revelations about the shenanigans at Wells Fargo, and I think Bank of America also was caught doing things with it. People were having accounts set up for them of which they had no knowledge. People lost their cars. And that would be subject to arbitration, that sort of thing?
Exactly. And again, it's the arbitrators tend to, not in all cases, I'm sure in some cases they do rule in favor of the customer, but they tend to be very business friendly. And again, if you're unhappy with it, well, that's basically your problem. There's not much you could do.
Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, has introduced and is really pushing his Protecting Consumers' Access to Credit Act of 2017, which is basically a predatory payday lender bill. I'm kind of surprised that he's promoting this. What can you tell us about this?
I haven't seen the specifics of it, so I can't say that much about it. But there have been efforts to restrict payday lending. Almost all of them are at the state level. the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has tried to regulate it some, and I can't say how successful they've been at this point. But just so people are clear, I mean, payday lending, oftentimes they get people into a trap where they say, okay, you have to pay us X amount on this loan. If you don't pay it back, and you expect it to pay it back typically in a very short period of time, a week, 2 weeks. And a lot of people find themselves in a trap where they end up taking out payday loans to pay off the last payday loan. And needless to say, that's a losing battle, because oftentimes you're looking at interest rates on the order of 200 or 300% a year. And, again, there have been efforts to regulate payday lending, again, almost entirely at the state level. And the industry's been fighting back. And just so people know, the payday lenders, I mean, you might see them on the street, and they look pretty downscale, they're pretty dumpy. But you have a lot of the biggest companies in the country that are actually tied up in it, and in particular, a lot of private equity companies are very big in payday lending. So these are not fly-by-night outfits. I mean, I'm sure some of them are, but many of them are actually very large companies that are involved in it.
The estate tax, we can't not talk about that, because that's a really big component of this. And also, that brings up not only Trump's benefits with this tax bill, but many of his rich appointees would benefit from this. Please talk about what the current situation is and what is being proposed in this tax plan.
Yeah, I'm really glad I forgot to mention the estate tax, and that is a big deal. The estate tax has it now. It exempts somewhere in the order, it's a little over $5 million. I don't know the exact sum, but a little over $5 million per person. So that means if you have a couple, they could pass on $10 million, more than $10 million to their kids, and no one pays a penny in the estate tax. So we're talking about a very small number of people that are affected by this, somewhere on the order of 0.2% of estates. They often put this as a small business story, and they talk about people losing their businesses, losing their farms. I remember many years ago when the estate tax actually had a much lower exempt amount. I think at that time it was around $1 million. But in any case, a much, much lower exempt amount. David K. Johnson is a great reporter for the New York Times. Still a great reporter. He's not the New York Times anymore. But in any case, he called up the Farm Bureau that was going out there lobbying for repeal of the estate tax, talking about how people are losing their farms. So I called him up and he said, can you put me in touch with some of the people who've lost their farms? And they said, well, we actually don't know of anyone. So they literally couldn't find a single person anywhere in the country who had lost their farm because of the estate tax. And that was when it had a much lower exemption than it is today. So this is just a massive giveaway that only goes to the very richest people in the country, by definition. Who else has $10 million to pass on to their kids? Now, the point you were making, and this is almost comical, if you were to say, how can we write a bill to help Donald Trump and his family as much as possible? It looks like what they did. So, of course, they eliminate the estate tax, and at least if he has even a fraction of what he claims to have, he's one of the people who would be paying the estate tax. So that's going to give his kids hundreds of millions of dollars that they otherwise would be paid as estate tax. I mentioned earlier the issue of pass-through income, that you have businesses that don't pay the tax directly. They pay it back to their owners, who then are liable for the taxes. Well, the one tax return that was disclosed, not by him as far as we know, but the one tax return that was made public, pretty much all his income came through pass-through businesses. So he would only be subject to a 25% tax rate rather than a 39.6% tax rate. He also gets rid of the alternative minimum tax. This is something that dates back from the early 70s, where basically the story is, okay, you have this loophole, that loophole, that loophole, so you don't have to pay any tax. Well, if you're above a certain income level, which he certainly is, you still have to, you're subject to the alternative minimum tax, where it's, I believe it's 22%. So you still have to pay that. They're repealing the alternative minimum tax. There's a provision where they reduce the amount that you could deduct for interest payments, except for real estate. Well, guess who's in real estate? Donald Trump. There's a provision for allowing golf courses to get a tax exemption for agreeing not to ever develop their land to build on their land, essentially. So what it means is, if you own a big golf course, you could say, okay, I waive my right ever to develop. You turn it over to, like, the Nature Conservatory. I'll never build on this. You get a tax deduction for that. Well, guess who owns golf courses? So you go down the list. As I say, I don't quite think they did this to make as much money as possible for Donald Trump, but if you were trying to make as much money as possible for Donald Trump, it's hard to see what you would have done differently.
I did note in my research that there is no deduction for sexual harassment settlements. So there's that. Any final words, Dean Baker, before we have to say goodbye? 30 seconds, please.
Well, I just say that this tax plan really is kind of crazy from just about every perspective. And, again, there's a lot of issues that we've hit on today, but I just hope the last thing I should just mention, the Senate plan proposes to get rid of the mandate for people buying health care insurance, which would totally undermine the individual insurance markets. So this is just an incredibly cynical plan to help the richest people in the country at the expense of everyone else.
We thank you for your many years of work and for helping us understand these things better, and also for the work that you do to make economics make sense, because so often it doesn't. We really appreciate it. Thank you, Dean Baker.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Dean Baker, co-founder, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire.